Mrs. Ramage, hardly dressed for a court ball herself, in her long white nightgown and muskrat's nightcap, with the untied curling ribbons hanging around her face like the fringe on a lampshade, stared at him with mounting concern. He had re-injured the ribs he had broken riding after the doctor 3 nights ago. That was obvious. But it wasn't just pain that made his eyes blaze from his whitened face like that. It was terror, barely held in check. "Mr. Jeffrey, what?" "No questions," he said hoarsely. "Not yet. Not until you answer one question of my own."
"What question?"
She was badly frightened now, her left hand clenched into a tight fist just above her munificent bosom. "Does the name Miss Evelyn Hyde mean anything to you?" And suddenly she knew the reason for that terrible thundery feeling that had been inside her ever since Saturday night. Some part of her mind must already have had this gruesome thought and suppressed it, for she needed no explanation at all. Only the name of the unfortunate Miss Charlotte Evelyn Hyde, late of Storping on Firkill, the village just to the west of Little Dunthorpe, was sufficient to bring a scream tearing from her.
"Oh, my saints! Oh, my dear Jesus! Has she been buried alive? Has she been buried alive? Has my darling Misery been buried alive?"
And now, before Jeffrey could even begin to answer, it was tough old Mrs. Ramage's turn to do something she had never done before that night and would never do again. She fainted, dead away. Chapter 5. Jeffrey had no time to look for smelling salts. He doubted if a tough old soldier as Mrs. Ramage kept them around anyway. But beneath her sink he found a rag which smelled faintly of ammonia. He did not just pass this beneath her nose, but pressed it briefly against her lower face. The possibility Coulter had raised, however faint, was too hideous to merit much in the way of consideration. She jerked, cried out, and opened her eyes. For a moment she looked at him with dazed, uncomprehending bewilderment. Then she sat up.
"No," she said. "No, Mr. Jeffrey. Say you don't mean it. Say it isn't true."
"I don't know if it's true or not," he said. "But we must satisfy ourselves immediately. Immediately, Mrs. Ramage. I can't do all the digging myself. And if there's digging that must be done..." She was staring at him with horrified eyes, her hands pressed so tightly over her mouth that the nails were white.
"Can you help me if help is needed? There's really no one else."
"My lord," she said numbly. "My lord, Mr. Ian, must know nothing of this until we know more," he said. "If God is good, he need never know at all." He would not voice to her the unspoken hope at the back of his mind, a hope which seemed to him almost as monstrous as his fears. If God was very good, he would find out about this night's work, when his wife and only love was restored to him, her return from the dead almost as miraculous as that of Lazarus.
"Oh, this is terrible, terrible," she said in a faint, fluttery voice.
Holding onto the table, she managed to pull herself to her feet. She stood swaying, little straggles of hair hanging around her face among the muskrat tails of her cap. "Are you well enough?" he asked, more kindly. "If not, then I must carry on as best I can by myself." She drew a deep, shuddering breath and let it out. The side-to-side sway stopped. She turned and walked toward the pantry. "There's a pair of spades in the shed out back," she said. "A pick as well, I think. Throw them in your trap. And there's half a bottle of gin out here in the pantry. Been here untouched since Bill died 5 years ago on Lammas night. I'll have a bit and then I'll join you, Mr. Jeffrey. You're a brave woman, Mrs. Ramage. Be quick." "Aye, never fear me," she said, and grasped the bottle of gin with a hand that trembled only slightly. There was no dust on the bottle. Not even the pantry was safe from the relentless dust cloud of Mrs. Ramage. But the label reading Clough and Poor Boozers was yellow. "Be quick yourself." She had always hated spirits, and her stomach wanted to sick the gin with its nasty junipery smell and oily taste back up. She made it stay down. Tonight, she would need it. Chapter 6. Under clouds that still raced east to west, blacker shapes against a black sky, and a moon that was now settling toward the horizon, the pony trap sped toward the churchyard. It was now Mrs. Ramage who drove, cracking the whip over the bewildered Mary, who would have told them, if horses could talk, that this was all wrong, that she was supposed to be dozing in her warm stall come this time of night. The spades and the pick chattered coldly one against the other, and Mrs. Ramage thought they would have given anyone who had seen them a proper They must look like a pair of Mr. Dickens' resurrection men, or perhaps one resurrection man sitting in a pony trap driven by a ghost. For she was all in white, had not even paused long enough to gather up her robe. Her nightgown fluttered around her stout, vein-puffed ankles, and the tails of her cap streamed wildly out behind her. Here was the church. She turned Mary up the lane which ran beside it, shivering at the ghostly sound the wind played along the eaves. She had a moment to wonder why such a holy place as a church should seem so frightening after dark, and then realized it was not the church, it was the errand. Her first thought upon coming out of her faint was that my lord must help them. Hadn't he been there in all things, through thick and thin, never wavering? A moment later she realized how mad the idea was. This was not a matter of my lord's courage, but of his very sanity. She hadn't needed Mr. Jeffrey to tell her so. The memory of Miss Evelyn Hyde had done that. She realized that neither Mr. Jeffrey nor my lord had been in Little Dunthorpe when it happened. This had been almost half a year ago in the spring. Misery had entered the rosy summer of her pregnancy, morning sickness behind her, the final rising of her belly and its attendant discomfort still ahead, and she had cheerfully sent the two men off for a week of grouse shooting and card playing and footballing and heaven alone knew what other masculine foolishness at Oak Hall in Doncaster. My lord had been a bit doubtful, but Misery assured him she would be fine, and nearly pushed him out the door. That Misery would be fine, Mrs. Ramage had no doubt. But whenever my lord and Mr. Jeffrey left for Doncaster, she wondered if one of them, or perhaps both, might not return on the back of a cart, toes up. Oak Hall was the inheritance of Albert Fossington, a schoolmate of Jeffrey's and Ian's. Mrs. Ramage quite rightly believed that Bertie Fossington was mad. Some 3 years ago, he had eaten his favorite polo pony after it had broken two legs and needed to be destroyed. It was a gesture of affection, he said.
Learned it from the fuzzy-wuzzies in Cape Town, he said. Griquas, wonderful chaps. Put sticks and things in their smooches, what? Some of them look like they could carry all 12 volumes of the Royal Navigation Charts on the lower lips, ha-ha. Taught me that each man must eat the thing he loves. Rather poetic in a grisly sort of way, what?
In spite of such bizarre behavior, Mr. Jeffrey and my lord retained a great affection for Bertie. I wonder if that means they'll have to eat him when he's dead. Mrs. Ramage had once wondered after a visit from Bertie, during which he had tried to play croquet with one of the house cats, quite shattering its poor little head. And they had spent nearly 10 days at Oak Hall this past spring. Not more than a day or two after they left, Miss Charlotte Evelyn Hyde of Storping on Firkill had been found dead on the back lawn of her home, Cove of Birches. There had been a freshly picked bunch of flowers near one outstretched hand. The village doctor was a man named Bilford, a capable man by all accounts. Nevertheless, he had called old Dr. Shinebone in to consult. Bilford had diagnosed the fatal malady as a heart attack, although the girl was very young, only 18, and had seemed in the pink of health. Bilford was puzzled. Something seemed not at all right. Old Shinny had been clearly puzzled as well, but in the end he had concurred with a diagnosis. So did most of the village, for that matter. The girl's heart had not been properly made, that was all. Such things were rare, but everyone could recall such a sad case at one time or another. It was probably this universal concurrence that had saved Bilford's practice, if not his head, following the ghastly denouement. Although everyone had agreed that the girl's death was puzzling, it had crossed no one's mind that she might not be dead at all. 4 days following the interment, an elderly woman named Mrs. Soames, Mrs. Ramage knew her slightly, had observed something white lying on the ground of the Congregational Church's cemetery as she entered it to put flowers on the grave of her husband, who had died the previous winter. It was much too big to be a flower petal, and she thought it might be a dead bird of some sort.
As she approached, she became more and more sure that the white object was not just lying on the ground, but protruding from it. She came two or three hesitant steps closer yet, and observed a hand reaching from the earth of a fresh grave, the fingers frozen in a hideous gesture of supplication. Blood-streaked bones protruded from the ends of all the digits, save the thumb. Mrs. Soames ran shrieking from the cemetery, ran all the way into Storping's High Street, a run of nearly a mile and a quarter, and reported her news to the barber, who was also the local constable. Then she had collapsed in a dead faint. She took to her bed later that afternoon and did not arise from it for nearly a month, nor did anyone in the village blame her in the least. The body of the unfortunate Miss Evelyn Hyde had been exhumed, of course, and as Geoffrey Alliburton drew Mary to a halt in front of the gate leading into Little Dunthorpe's C of E churchyard, Mrs. Ramage found herself wishing fervently that she had not listened to the tales of the exhumation. They had been dreadful. Dr. Bilford, shaken to within an inch of sanity himself, diagnosed catalepsy. The poor woman had apparently fallen into some sort of death-like trance, much like the sort those Indian fakers could voluntarily induce in themselves before allowing themselves to be buried alive, or to have needles passed through their flesh. She had remained in this trance for perhaps 48 hours, perhaps 60. Long enough, at any rate, to have awakened not to find herself on her back lawn where she had been picking flowers, but buried alive in her own coffin. She had fought grimly for her life, that girl, and Mrs. Ramage found now, following Geoffrey through the gates and into a thin mist that turned the leaning grave markers into islands, that what should have redeemed with nobility only made it seem all the more horrid. The girl had been engaged to be married. In her left hand, not the one frozen above the soil like the hand of a drowned woman, had been her diamond engagement ring. With it she had slit the satin lining of her coffin, and over God knew how many hours she had used it to claw away at the coffin's wooden lid. In the end, air running out, she had apparently used the ring with her left hand to cut and excavate, and her right hand to dig. It had not been quite enough. Her complexion had been a deep purple from which her blood-rimmed eyes stared in a bulging expression of terminal horror. The clock in the church tower began to chime the hour of 12, the hour when, her mother had told her, the door between life and death sways open a bit, and the dead may pass both ways. And it was all Mrs. Ramage could do to keep herself from shrieking and fleeing in a panic, which would not abate, but grow stronger with each step. And if she began running, she knew she would simply run until she fell down insensible. "Stupid, fearful woman," she berated herself, and then amended that to, "Stupid, fearful, selfish woman. It's my lord you want to be thinking of now, not your own fears. My lord, and if there is even one chance that my lady..." Ah, but no. It was madness to even think of such a thing. It had been too long, too long, too long. Geoffrey had led her to Misery's tombstone, and the two of them stood looking down at it, as if mesmerized. Lady Calthorpe, the stone read. Other than the dates of her birth and death, the only inscription was, "Loved by many." She looked at Geoffrey and said, like one awakening from a deep daze, "You've not brought the tools." "No, not yet," he responded, and threw himself full length on the ground and placed his ear against the earth, which had already begun to show the first tender shoots of new grass between the rather carelessly replaced sods. For a moment, the only expression she saw there by the lamp she carried was the one Geoffrey had worn since she had first opened the door to him, a look of agonized dread. Then a new expression began to surface. This new expression was one of utter horror mingled with an almost demented hope. He looked up at Mrs. Ramage, eyes staring, mouth working. "I believe she lives," he whispered strengthlessly. "Oh, Mrs. Ramage." Suddenly he turned over onto his belly and screamed at the ground. Under other circumstances it would have been comic.
"Misery! Misery! We're here! We know! Hold on! Hold on, my darling!"
He was on his feet a moment later, sprinting back toward the pony trap where the digging tools were, his slippered feet sending the placid ground mist into excited little roils. Mrs. Ramage's knees unlocked, and she buckled forward, near to swooning again. Of its own accord, seemingly, her head slipped to one side, so her right ear was pressed against the ground. She had seen children in similar postures by the railway line, listening for trains. And she heard it. Low, painful scraping sounds in the earth. Not the sounds of a burrowing animal, these. These were the sounds of fingers scraping helplessly on wood. She drew in breath, in one great convulsive gulp, restarting her own heart, it seemed. She shrieked,
"We're coming, my lady! Praise God and plead, sweet Jesus, we'll be in time! We're coming!"
She began to pull half-healed turves out of the ground with her trembling fingers, and although Geoffrey returned in almost no time, she had by then already clawed a hole some 8 inches deep. He was already 9 pages into Chapter 7. Geoffrey and Mrs. Ramage had managed to get Misery out of her grave, and in the barest nick of time, only to realize that the woman had no idea at all who they were, or who she herself was, when Annie came into the room. This time, Paul heard her. He stopped typing, sorry to be out of the dream. She held the first 6 chapters at the side of her skirt. It had taken her less than 20 minutes to read his first stab at it. It had been an hour since she had taken this sheaf of 21 pages. He looked at her steadily, observing with faint interest that Annie Wilkes was a bit pale. "Well," he asked, "is it fair?"
"Yes,"
she said absently, as if this was a foregone conclusion, and Paul supposed it was.
"It's fair, and it's good, exciting, but it's gruesome, too. It's not like any of the other Misery books. That poor woman who scraped the ends of her fingers off..."
She shook her head and repeated,
"It's not like any of the other Misery books."
"The man who wrote these pages was in a rather gruesome frame of mind, my dear," Paul thought. "Shall I go on?" he asked.
"I'll kill you if you don't,"
she responded, smiling a little. Paul didn't smile back. This comment, which would once have struck him as in a league with such banalities as,
"You look so good I could just eat you up,"
now seemed not banal at all. Yet something in her attitude as she stood in the doorway fascinated him. It was as if she was a little frightened to come any closer, as if she thought something in him might burn her. It wasn't the subject of premature burial that had done it, and he was wise enough to know it. No, it was the difference between his first try and this one. That first one had had all the life of an 8th grader's "How I Spent My Summer Vacation" theme. This one was different. The furnace was on. Oh, not that he had written particularly well. The story was hot, but the characters as stereotyped and predictable as ever. But this time he had been able to at least generate some power. This time there was heat baking out from between the lines. Amused, he thought, "She felt the heat. I think she's afraid to get too close in case I might burn her." "Well," he said mildly, "you won't have to kill me, Annie. I want to go on. So why don't I get at it?"
"All right," she said.
She brought the pages to him, put them on the board, and then stepped back quickly. "Would you like to read it as I go along?" he asked. Annie smiled.
"Yes. It would be almost like the chapter plays when I was a kid."
"Well, I can't promise a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter," he said. "It just doesn't work that way."
"It will for me," she said fervently. "I'd want to know what was going to happen in Chapter 18, even if 17 ended with Misery and Ian and Geoffrey sitting in armchairs on the porch reading newspapers. I'm already wild to know what's going to happen next. Don't tell me,"
she added sharply, as if Paul had offered to do this. "Well, I generally don't show my work until it's all done," he said, and then smiled at her. "But since this is a special situation, I'll be happy to let you read it chapter by chapter." And so began the 1001 Nights of Paul Sheldon, he thought.
But I wonder if you'd do something for me.
What?
Fill in these damned ends, he said. She smiled at him radiantly.
It'd be an honor. I'll leave you alone now.
She went back to the door, hesitated there, and turned back. Then, with a deep and almost painful timidity, she offered the only editorial suggestion she ever made to him.
Maybe it was a bee.
He had already dropped his gaze to the sheet of paper in the typewriter. He was looking for the hole. He wanted to get Misery back to Mrs. Ramage's cottage before he knocked off, and he looked back up at Annie with carefully disguised impatience. I beg pardon?
A bee,
she said. And he saw a blush creeping up her neck and over her cheeks. Soon even her ears were glowing.
One person in every dozen is allergic to bee venom. I saw lots of cases of it before I retired from service as an RN. The allergy can show in a lot of different ways. Sometimes a sting can cause a comatose condition, which is similar to what people used to call, catalepsy.
Now she was so red she was almost purple. Paul held the idea up briefly in his mind and then tossed it on the scrap heap. A bee could have been the cause of Miss Evelyn Hyde's unfortunate live burial. It even made sense, since it had happened in mid-spring, in the garden to boot. But he had already decided that credibility depended on the two live burials being related somehow, and Misery had succumbed in her bedroom. The fact that late fall was hardly bee season was not really the problem. The problem was the rarity of the cataleptic reaction. He thought Constant Reader would not swallow two unrelated women in neighboring townships being buried alive 6 months apart as a result of bee stings. Yet he could not tell Annie that, and not just because it might rile her up. He could not tell her because it would hurt her badly, and in spite of all the pain she had afforded him, he found he could not hurt her in that way. He had been hurt that way himself. He fell back on that most common writer's workshop euphemism. It's got possibilities, all right. I'll drop it into the hopper, Annie. They've already got some ideas in mind. It may not fit.
Oh, I know that. You're the writer, not me. Just forget I said anything. I'm sorry.
Don't be... But she was gone, her heavy tread almost running down the hallway to the parlor. He was looking at an empty space. His eyes dropped, then widened. On either side of the doorway, about 8 inches up from the floor, was a black mark. They had been left, he understood at once, by the hubs of his wheelchair when he forced it through. So far, she hadn't noticed them. It had been almost a week, and her failure to notice was a small miracle. But soon, tomorrow, perhaps even this afternoon, she would be into vacuum, and then she would. She would. Paul managed very little during the rest of the day. The hole in the paper had disappeared. The following morning, Paul was sitting up in bed, propped on a pile of pillows, drinking a cup of coffee and eyeing those marks on the sides of the door with the guilty eye of a murderer who has just seen some bloody item of clothing of which he has somehow neglected to dispose. Suddenly, Annie came rushing into the room, her eyes wide and bulging. She held a dustcloth in one hand. In the other, incredibly, she held a pair of handcuffs. What? It was all he had time for. She seized him with panicky strength and pulled him into an upright sitting position. Pain, the worst in days, bellowed through his legs and he screamed. The coffee cup flew out of his hand and shattered on the floor. Things keep breaking in here, he thought. And then she saw the marks. Of course, probably a long time ago. That was the only way he could have kept bizarre behavior. She had seen the marks after all, and this was the beginning of some new and spectacular punishment.
Shut up, stupid!
She hissed. And then his hands were pinned behind him, and just as he heard the click of the handcuffs, he also heard a car turning into the driveway. He opened his mouth, meaning to speak or perhaps scream again, and she stuffed the rag into it before he could do either. There was some ghastly dead taste on the rag. Pledge, he supposed, or end dust, or something like that.
Make no sound, she said,
leaning over him with one hand on either side of his head,
strands of her hair tickling his cheeks and forehead. I warn you, Paul, if whoever that is hears something, or even if I hear something and think he might have heard something, I will kill him or them, then you, then myself.
She stood up. Her eyes were bulging. There was sweat on her face and dried egg yolk on her lips.
Remember, Paul.
He was nodding, but she didn't see. She was already running out. An old but well-preserved Chevy Bel Air had pulled up behind Annie's Cherokee. Paul heard a door open somewhere off the parlor and then bang shut. It gave off the oddly interrogative squeak that told him it was the closet where she kept her outdoor stuff. The man getting out of the car was as old and well-preserved as the car itself, a Colorado type if ever Paul had seen one. He looked 65 but might be 80. He might be the senior partner of a law firm or the semi-retired patriarch of a construction company, but was more likely a rancher or a realtor. He would be a Republican of the sort who would no more put a bumper sticker on his car than he would put a pair of pointy-toed Italian shoes on his feet. He must also be some sort of town official, and here on town business, because it was only on town business that a man like this and a reclusive woman like Annie Wilkes would have occasion to meet. Paul watched her hasten down the walk to the driveway, intent not on meeting but intercepting him. Here was something much like his earlier fantasy come true. Not a cop, but someone in authority. Authority had arrived at Annie's, and its arrival here could do nothing but shorten his own life. Why not invite him in, Annie? He thought, trying not to choke on the dusty rag. Why not invite him in and your African bird? Oh, no. She would no more invite Mr. Rocky Mountain businessman in than she would drive Paul to Stapleton International and put a first-class ticket back to New York in his hand. She was talking even before she reached him, the breath pluming out of her mouth in shapes like cartoon balloons with no words written inside them. He held out a hand dressed in a narrowly elegant black leather glove. She looked at it briefly, contemptuously, then began to shake a finger in his face, more of those empty white balloons puffing from her mouth. She finished struggling into her coat and stopped shaking her finger long enough to rake the zipper up. He reached into the pocket of his topcoat and brought out a sheet of paper. He held it out to her almost apologetically. Although Paul had no way of knowing exactly what it was, he was sure that Annie had an adjective for it. Cockadoody, maybe. She led him along the driveway, still talking. They passed beyond his sight line. He could see their shadows lying like construction paper cutouts on the snow, but that was all. She had done it on purpose, he realized dully. If he, Paul, couldn't see them, then there was no chance that Mr. Rancho Grande might look in through the guest room window and see him. The shadows remained on the melting snowpack of Annie's driveway for about 5 minutes. Once Paul actually heard Annie's voice, raised in an angry, hectoring shout. Those were a long 5 minutes for Paul. His shoulders ached. He found he couldn't move to ease the ache. After cuffing his hands together, she had somehow bound them to the bedstead. But the dustcloth in his mouth was the worst. The stink of the furniture polish was making his head ache, and he was growing steadily more nauseated. He concentrated grimly on controlling it. He had no interest in choking to death, his windpipe full of vomit, while Annie argued with an elderly town official who got his hair trimmed once a week at a local tonsorial emporium and probably wore rubbers over his black Oxfords all winter long. Cold, sick sweat had broken on his forehead by the time they reappeared. Now Annie was holding the paper. She followed Mr. Rancho Grande, shaking her finger at his back, those empty cartoon balloons issuing from her mouth. Mr. Rancho Grande would not look around at her. His face was carefully blank. Only his lips, pressed together so tightly that they almost disappeared, gave away some inward emotion. Anger? Perhaps. Distaste? Yes. That was probably closer. You think she's crazy. You and all your poker cronies. You probably control this whole minor league ballpark of a town. Probably played a hand of lowball or something to see who got this shit detail. No one likes to bring bad news to crazy people. But oh, Mr. Rancho Grande, if you knew just how crazy she really is, I don't think you'd turn your back on her like that. He got into the Bel Air. He closed the door. Now she stood beside the car, shaking her finger at his closed window. And again Paul could dimly hear her voice.
Think you are so smart.
The Bel Air began to back slowly down the driveway. Mr. Rancho Grande was ostentatiously not looking at Annie, whose teeth were bared. Louder still.
You think you are such a great big wheel.
Suddenly she kicked the front bumper of Mr. Rancho Grande's car, kicked it hard enough to knock packed chunks of snow out of the wheel wells. The old guy had been looking over his right shoulder, guiding the car down the driveway. Now he looked back at her, startled out of the careful neutrality he had maintained all through his visit.
Well, I'll tell you something, you dirty bird. Little dogs go to the bathroom all over big wheels. What do you think of that, huh?
Whatever he thought of it, Mr. Rancho Grande was not going to give Annie the satisfaction of seeing it. That neutral expression dropped over his face again like the visor on a suit of armor. He backed out of Paul's sight. She stood there for a moment, hands fisted on hips, then stalked back toward the house. He heard the kitchen door open and explode shut. Well, he's gone, Paul thought. Mr. Rancho Grande is gone, but I'm here. Oh, yes, I'm here. But this time she didn't take her anger out on him. She came into his room, her coat still on, but now unzipped. She began to pace rapidly back and forth, not even looking his way. The piece of paper was still in her hand, and every now and then she would shake it in front of her own nose, as if in self-chastisement.
10% tax increase, he says. In arrears, he says. Liens, lawyers. Quarterly payment, he says. Overdue, cock-a-doody, caca, caca-poopy-doopy.
He grunted into the rag, but she didn't look around. She was in a room by herself. She walked back and forth faster, cutting the air with her solid body. He kept thinking she would tear the paper to shreds, but it seemed she did not quite dare do this.
$506,
she cried, this time brandishing the paper in front of his nose. She absently tore the rag that was choking him out of his mouth and threw it on the floor. He hung his head over to one side, dry heaving. His arms felt as if they were slowly detaching themselves from their sockets.
$506.17. They know I don't want anyone out here. I told them, didn't I? And look, look.
He dry heaved again, making a desperate burping sound.
If you vomit, I guess you'll just have to lie in it. Looks like I've got other fish to fry. He said something about a lien on my house. What's that?
Handcuffs, he croaked.
Yes, yes, she said impatiently. Sometimes you're such a baby.
She pulled the key from her skirt pocket and pushed him even farther to the left, so that his nose pressed the sheets. He screamed, but she ignored him. There was a click, a rattle, and then his hands were free. He sat up gasping, then slid slowly down against his pillows, mindful to push his legs straight ahead as he did. There were pale furrows in his thin wrists. As he watched, they began to fill in red. Annie stuffed the cups absently into her skirt pocket, as if police restraints were found in most decent houses, like Kleenex or coat hangers.
What's a lien? She asked again. Does that mean they own my house? Is that what it means?
No, he said. It means that you... He cleared his throat and got another aftertaste of that fumy dust rag. His chest hitched as he dry heaved again. She took no notice of that, simply stood impatiently staring at him until he could talk. After a while, he could.
Just means you can't sell it.
Just? You got a funny idea of just, Mr. Paul Sheldon. But I suppose the troubles of a poor widow like me don't seem very important to a rich Mr. Smart Guy like you.
On the contrary, I think of your troubles as my troubles, Annie. I just mean that a lien isn't much compared to what they could do if you got seriously in arrears. Are you?
Arrears? That means in the bucket, doesn't it?
In the bucket, in the hole, behind, yes.
I'm no shanty Irish moocher.
He saw the thin sheen of her teeth as her upper lip lifted.
I pay my bills. This time I just...
You forgot, didn't you? You forgot, just the way you keep forgetting to change February on that damn calendar. Forgetting to make the quarterly property tax payment is a hell of a lot more serious than forgetting to change the calendar page. And you're upset because this is the first time you forgot something that big. Fact is, you're getting worse, Annie, aren't you? A little worse every day. Psychotics can cope in the world after a fashion, and sometimes, as I think you well know, they get away with some very nasty shit. But there's a borderline between the lands of manageable and unmanageable psychosis. You're getting closer to that line every day, and part of you knows it.
I just hadn't gotten around to it yet,
Annie said sullenly.
Having you here has kept me busier than a one-armed paper hanger.
An idea occurred to him, a really fine one. The potential for brownie points in this idea seemed almost unlimited. I know, he said with quiet sincerity. I owe you my life, and I haven't been anything but a pain in the tail to you. I've got about $400 in my wallet. I want you to pay your arrears with it.
Oh, Paul.
She was looking at him, both confused and pleased.
I couldn't take your money.
It's not mine, he said. He grinned at her, his number one, who loves you, baby, grin. And inside he thought, what I want, Annie, is for you to do one of your forgetting acts when I've got access to one of your knives, and I'm sure I can move well enough to use it. You'll be frying in hell 10 seconds before you know you're dead. It's yours. Call it a down payment if you want. He paused, then took a calculated risk. If you don't think I know I'd be dead if it wasn't for you, you're crazy.
Paul, I don't know.
I'm serious. He allowed his smile to melt into an expression of winning, or so he hoped. Please, God, let it be winning. Sincerity. You did more than save my life, you know. You saved two lives. Because without you, Misery would still be lying in her grave. Now she was looking at him shiningly, the paper in her hand forgotten. And you showed me the error of my ways, got me back on track again. I owe you a lot more than $400 just for that. And if you don't take that money, you're going to make me feel bad.
Well, all right, thank you.
I should be thanking you. May I see that paper? She gave it to him with no protest at all. It was an overdue tax notice. The lien was little more than a formality. He scanned it quickly, then handed it back. Have you got money in the bank? Her eyes shifted away from his.
I've got a little put aside, but not in the bank. I don't believe in banks.
This says they can't execute the lien on you unless the bill remains unpaid by March 25th. What's today? She frowned at the calendar.
Goodness, that's wrong.
She untacked it, and the boy on his sled disappeared. Paul watched this happen with an absurd pang of regret. March showed a white water stream rushing pell-mell between snowy banks. She peered myopically at the calendar for a moment and then said,
Today is March 25th.
Christ, so late. So late, he thought.
Sure, that's why he came out.
He wasn't telling you they had slapped a lien on your house, Annie. He was telling you they would have to if you didn't cough up by the time the town offices closed tonight. Guy was actually trying to do you a favor. But if you pay this $506 before...
And 17 cents,
she put in fiercely.
Don't forget the cock-a-doody 17 cents.
All right, and 17 cents. If you pay it before they close down the town offices this afternoon, no lien. If people in town really feel about you the way you say they do, Annie...
They hate me. They're all against me, Paul.
Then your taxes are one of the ways they'll try to pry you out. Hollering lien at someone who has missed one quarterly property payment is pretty weird. It smells. Well, it stinks. If you missed a couple of quarterly payments, they might try to take your home, sell it at auction. It's a crazy idea, but I guess they're technically within their rights.
She laughed, a harsh barking sound.
Let them try. I'd gut haul a few of them, I'll tell you that much. Yes, sir, yes, siree, Bob.
In the end, they'll gut haul you, he said quietly. But that isn't the point.
Then what is?
Annie, there are probably people in Sidewinder who are 2 or 3 years behind on their taxes. No one is taking their homes or auctioning their furnishings down at the town hall. The worst that happens to people like that most of the time is that they lose their town water. The Roydmans now. He looked at her shrewdly. You think they pay their taxes on time?
That white trash?
She nearly shrieked.
Ha!
I think they're on the prod for you, Annie. He did, in fact, believe this.
I'll never go. I'll stay up here just to spite them. I'll stay up here and spit in their eye.
Can you come up with $106 to go with the $400 in my wallet?
Yes.
She was beginning to look cautiously relieved. Good enough, he said. Then I suggest you pay their crappy tax bill today. And while you're gone, I'll see what I can do about those damned marks on the door. And when that's done, I believe I'll see if I can do anything about getting the fuck out of here, Annie. I'm a little tired of your hospitality. He managed to smile. I think there must be at least 17 cents there in the night table, he said. Annie Wilkes had her own interior set of rules. In her way, she was strangely prim. She had made him drink water from a floor bucket, had withheld his medication until he was in agony, had made him burn the only copy of his new novel, had handcuffed him and stuck a rag reeking of furniture polish in his mouth. But she would not take money from his wallet. She brought it to him, the old scuffed Lord Buxton he'd had since college, and put it in his hands. All the ID had, at that she had not scrupled. He did not ask her about it. It seemed wiser not to. The ID was gone, but the money was still there. The bills, mostly 50s, crisp and fresh. With a clarity that was both surprising and somehow ominous, he saw himself pulling the Camaro up to the drive-in window of the Boulder Bank the day before he had finished Fast Cars, and dropping his check for $450, made out to cash and endorsed on the back, into the tray. Perhaps even then the guys in the sweatshops had been talking vacation. He thought it likely. The man who had done that had been free and healthy and feeling good, and had been without the wit to appreciate any of those fine things. The man who had done that had eyed the drive-up teller with a lively, interested eye. Tall, blonde, wearing a purple dress that had cupped her curves with a lover's touch. And she had eyed him back. What would she think, he wondered, of that man as he looked now, 40 pounds lighter and 10 years older, his legs a pair of crooked, useless horrors? Paul. He looked up at her, holding the money in one hand. There was 420 in all. Yes. She was looking at him with that disconcerting expression of maternal love and tenderness, disconcerting because of the total solid blackness underlying it. Are you crying, Paul? He brushed his cheek with his free hand, and yes, there was moisture there. He smiled and handed her the money. A little. I was thinking how good you've been to me. Oh, I suppose a lot of people wouldn't understand. But I think I know. Her own eyes glistened as she leaned forward and gently touched his lips. He smelled something on her breath, something from the dark and sour chambers inside her, something that smelled like dead fish. It was 1,000 times worse than the taste smell of the dust rag. It brought back the memory of her sour breath.
Breathe, goddammit! Breathe!
Blowing down his throat like a dirty wind from hell. His stomach clenched, but he smiled at her.
I love you, dear, she said.
Would you put me in my chair before you go? I want to write.
Of course, she hugged him. Of course, my dear.
Her tenderness did not extend to leaving the bedroom door unlocked, but this presented no problem. He was not half mad with pain and withdrawal symptoms this time. He had collected 4 of her bobby pins as assiduously as a squirrel collects nuts for the winter, and he had secreted them under his mattress along with the pills. When he was sure she was really gone and not hanging around to see if he was going to get up to dittos, another Wilkesism for his growing lexicon, he rolled the wheelchair over to the bed and got the pins, along with a pitcher of water and the box of Kleenex from the night table. Rolling the wheelchair with a royal perched on the board of the front of him was not very difficult. His arms had gotten a lot stronger. Annie Wilkes might be surprised to know just how strong they were now, and he sincerely hoped that someday soon she would be. The royal typewriter made a shitty writing machine, but as an exercise tool it was great. He had begun lifting it and setting it down whenever he was pinned in the chair behind it, and she was out of the room. 5 lifts of 6 inches or so had been the best he could manage at first. Now he could do 18 or 20 without a pause. Not bad when you considered the bastard weighed at least 50 pounds. He worked on the lock with one of the bobby pins, holding 2 spares in his mouth like a seamstress hemming a dress. He thought that the piece of bobby pin still somewhere inside the lock might screw him up, but it didn't. He caught the rocker almost at once and pushed it up, drawing the lock's tongue along with it. He had just a moment to wonder if she might not have put a bolt on the outside of the door as well. He had tried very hard to seem weaker and sicker than he now really felt, but the suspicions of the true paranoiac spread wide and run deep. Then the door was open. He felt the same nervous guilt, the urge to do this fast. Ears attuned for the sound of old Bessie returning, although she'd only been gone 45 minutes. He pulled a bunch of the Kleenex, dipped the wad in the pitcher, and bent awkwardly over to one side with a soppy mass in his hand. Gritting his teeth and ignoring the pain, he began to rub at the mark on the right-hand side of the door. To his intense relief, it began to fade almost at once. The hubs of the wheelchair had not actually scored through the paint as he had feared, but only scuffed it. He reversed away from the door, turned the chair, and backed up so he could work on the other mark. When he had done all he could, he reversed again and looked at the door, trying to see it through Annie's exquisitely suspicious eyes. The marks were there, but faint, almost unnoticeable. He thought he would be okay. He hoped he would be okay. "Tornado cellars," he said, licked his lips and laughed dryly. "What the fuck, friends and neighbors?" He rolled back to the door and looked out at the corridor. But now that the marks were gone, he felt no urge to go farther or dare more today. Another day, yes. He would know that day when it came around. What he wanted to do now was right. He closed the door, and the click of the lock seemed very loud. Africa. That bird came from Africa. But you mustn't cry for that bird, Polly, because after a while it forgot about how the veldt smelled at noonday, and the sounds of the wildebeests at the waterhole, and the high acidic smell of the yucca-yucca trees in the great clearing north of the big road. After a while it forgot the cerise color of the sun dying behind Kilimanjaro. After a while it only knew the muddy, smogged-out sunsets of Boston. That was all it remembered, and all it wanted to remember. After a while it didn't want to go back anymore. And if someone took it back and set it free, it would only crouch in one place, afraid and hurting and homesick in 2 unknown and terribly ineluctable directions, until something came along and killed it. "Oh, Africa. Oh, shit," he said in a trembling voice. Crying a little, he rolled the wheelchair over to the wastebasket and buried the wet wads of Kleenex under the waste paper. He repositioned the wheelchair by the window and rolled a piece of paper into the royal. "And by the way, Polly, is the bumper sticker of your car sticking out of the snow yet? Is it sticking out, twinkling cheerily in the sun, just waiting for someone to come along and see it, while you sit here wasting what may be your last chance?" He looked doubtfully at the blank sheet of paper in the typewriter. "I won't be able to write now anyway. That spoiled it." But nothing had ever spoiled it somehow. It could be spoiled, he knew that. But in spite of the reputed fragility of the creative act, it had always been the single toughest thing, the most abiding thing in his life. Nothing had ever been able to pollute that crazy well of dreams. No drink, no drug, no pain. He fled to that well now, like a thirsty animal finding a waterhole at dusk, and he drank from it. Which is to say, he found the hole in the paper and fell thankfully through it. By the time Annie got back home at 6:15, he had done almost 5 pages. During the next 3 weeks, Paul Sheldon felt surrounded by a queer electric peacefulness. His mouth was always dry. Sound seemed too loud. There were days when he felt he could bend spoons simply by looking at them. Other days he felt like weeping hysterically. Outside this, separate of the atmosphere and apart from the deep, maddening itch of his healing legs, its own serene thing, the work continued. The stack of pages to the right of the Royal grew steadily taller. Before this strange experience, he had considered 4 pages a day to bars it had usually been 3, and only 2 on many days, before the final finishing sprint. But during this electric 3-week period, which came to an end with a rainstorm of April 15th, Paul averaged 12 pages a day, 7 in the morning, 5 more in an evening session. If anyone in his previous life, or so he had come to think of it, without even realizing it, had suggested he could work at such a pace, Paul would have laughed. When the rain began to fall, he had 267 pages of Misery's Return. First draft stuff, sure, but he had scanned through it and thought it amazingly clean for a first. Part of the reason was that he was living an amazingly straight life. No long, muddled nights spent bar hopping, followed by long, muddled days spent drinking coffee and orange juice and gobbling vitamin B tablets. Days when, if his glance so much as happened upon his typewriter, he would turn away, shuddering. No more waking up next to a big blonde or redhead he had picked up somewhere the night before, a lass who usually looked like a queen at midnight and a goblin at 10 the next morning. No more cigarettes. He had once asked for them in a timid and tentative voice, and she had given him a look of such utter darkness that he had told her at once to forget it. He was Mr. Clean. No bad habits, except for his codeine, Jones, of course. Still haven't done anything about that, have we, Paul? No distractions. Here I am, the world's only monastic druggie. Up at 7. Down 2 Norville with juice. At 8 o'clock, breakfast came, served at Monsieur's bedside. A single egg, poached or scrambled 3 days a week. High-fiber cereal the other 4 days. Then into the wheelchair. Over to the window. Find the hole in the paper. Fall into the 19th century, where men were men and women wore bustles. Lunch. Afternoon nap. Up again, sometimes to edit, sometimes just to read. She had everything Somerset Maugham had ever written. Once Paul found himself wondering dourly if she had John Fowle's first novel on her shelves and decided it might be better not to ask. And Paul began to work his way through the 20-odd volumes that comprised Maugham's oeuvre, fascinated by the man's canny grasp of story values. Over the years, Paul had grown more and more resigned to the fact that he could not read stories as he had when he was a kid. By becoming a writer of them himself, he had condemned himself to a life of dissection. But Maugham first seduced him, and then made him a child again, and that was wonderful. At 5 o'clock she would serve him a light supper, and at 7 she would roll in the black-and-white television, and they would watch MASH and WKRP in Cincinnati. When these were over, Paul would write. When he was done, he would roll the wheelchair slowly. He could have gone much faster, but it was just as well that Annie should not know that. Over to the bed. She would hear, come in, and help him back into bed. More medication. Boom, out like a light. And the next day would be just the same. And the next. And the next. Being such a straight arrow was part of the reason for this amazing fecundity, but Annie herself was a bigger one. After all, it was her single hesitant suggestion about the bee sting which had shaped the book and given it its urgency, when Paul had firmly believed he could never feel urgent about Misery again. He'd been sure of one thing from the start. There really was no Misery's Return. His attention had been focused only on finding a way to get the bitch out of her grave without cheating, before Annie decided to inspire him by giving him an enema with a handful of Ginsu knives.
Minor matters, such as what the fucking book was supposed to be about, would have to wait. During the 2 days following Annie's trip to town to pay her tax bill, Paul tried to forget his failure to take advantage of what could have been a golden opportunity to escape, and concentrated on getting Misery back to Mrs. Ramage's cottage instead. Taking her to Jeffrey's home was no good. The servants, most notably Jeffrey's gossipy butler, Tyler, would see and talk. Also, he needed to establish the total amnesia which had been caused by the shock of being buried alive. Amnesia? Shit, the chick could barely talk. Sort of a relief, given Misery's usual burblings. So, what next? The bitch was out of her grave. Now where was the fucking story? Should Jeffrey and Mrs. Ramage tell Ian that Misery was still alive? Paul didn't think so, but he wasn't sure. Not being sure of things he knew was a charmless corner of purgatory reserved for writers who were driving fast with no idea at all where they were going. Not Ian, he thought, looking out at the barn. Not Ian, not yet. The doctor first. That old asshole with all the N's in his name. Scheinbone. The thought of the doctor brought Annie's comment about the bee stings to mind, and not for the first time. It kept recurring at odd moments. One person in every dozen. But it just wouldn't play. Two unrelated women in neighboring townships, both allergic to stings in the same rare way. 3 days following the great Annie Wilkes tax bailout, Paul had been drowsing his way into his afternoon nap when the guys in the sweatshop weighed in, and weighed in heavy. This time it wasn't a flare. This time it was an H-bomb explosion. He sat bolt upright in bed, ignoring the flare of pain which shot up his legs. Annie, he bawled. Annie, come in here. He heard her thump down the stairs two at a time and then run down the hallway. Her eyes were wide and scared when she came in.
Paul, what's wrong? Are you cramping? Are you...
No, he said, but of course he was. His mind was cramping. No, Annie, I'm sorry if I scared you, but you gotta help me into the chair. Mighty fuck, I got it. The dreaded F-word was out before he could help it, but this time it didn't seem to matter. She was looking at him respectfully, and with not a little awe. Here was the secular version of the Pentecostal fire, burning before her very eyes.
Of course, Paul.
She got him into the chair as quickly as she could. She began to roll him toward the window, and Paul shook his head impatiently. This won't take long, he said, but it's very important.
Is it about the book?
It is the book. Be quiet. Don't talk to me. Ignoring the typewriter, he never used the typewriter to make notes. He seized one of the ballpoints and quickly covered a single sheet of paper with a scrawl that probably no one but himself could have read. They were related. It was bees, and it affected them both the same way because they were related. Misery's an orph. And guess what? The Evelyn Hyde babe was Misery's sister. Or maybe half-sister. That would probably work better. Who gets the first hint? Shinny? No, Shinny's a ninny. Mrs. R. She can go see Charles E.H.'s mommy and... And now he was struck by an idea of such intense loveliness, in terms of the plot at least, that he looked up, mouth open, eyes wide.
Paul?
Annie asked anxiously.
She knew,
Paul whispered.
Of course she did. At least strongly suspected, but...
He bent to his notes again. She, Mrs. R., realizes at once that Mrs. E.H. has got to know M is related to her dot. Same hair or something. Remember, E.H.'s mom is starting to look like a mage character. You'll need to work her up. Mrs. R. starts to realize Mrs. E.H. may even have known Misery was buried alive. Shit on a shingle, love it. Suppose the old lady guessed Misery was a leftover of her fuck-em-and-leave-em days and... He put the pen down, looked at the paper, then slowly picked up the pen again and scrawled a few more lines. Three necessary points. One, how does Mrs. E.H. react to Mrs. R.'s suspicions? She should be either murderous or puked up scared. I prefer scared, but think A.W. would like murderous, so okay, murd. Two. How does... Three. Amnesia's one to...
Does Misery find out her mom lived with the possibility that not just one but two of her daughters had been buried alive rather than speak up? Why not? You could help me back into bed now if you wanted, Paul said. I was just excited. That's all right, Paul. She still sounded awed. Since then, the work had driven on famously. Annie was right. The story was turning out to be a good deal more gruesome than the other Misery books. The first chapter had not been a fluke, but a harbinger. But it was also more richly plotted than any Misery novel since the first, and the characters were more lively. The latter three Misery novels had been little more than straightforward adventure tales, with a fair amount of piquantly described sex thrown in to please the ladies. This book, he began to understand, was a gothic novel, and thus was more dependent on plot than on situation. The challenges were constant. It was not just a question of can you to begin the book. For the first time in years, it was can you almost every day, and he was finding he could. Then the rain came and things changed. From the 8th of April until the 14th, they enjoyed an unbroken run of fine weather. The sun beamed down from a cloudless sky, and the temperatures sometimes rose into the mid-60s. Brown patches began to appear in the field behind Annie's knee. He hid behind his work not to think about his car, the discovery of which was already over. His work did not. His mood did. He felt more and more that he was living in a cloud chamber, breathing an atmosphere thick with uncoalesced electricity. Whenever the Camaro stole into his mind, he immediately called the brain police and had the thought led away in handcuffs and leg irons. Trouble was, the nasty thing had a way of escaping and coming back time after time, in one form or another. One night he dreamed that Mr. Rancho Grande returned to Annie's place. He got out of his well-kept Chevrolet Bel Air, holding part of the Camaro's bumper in one hand and its steering wheel in the other. "Do these belong to you?" he asked Annie in his dream. Paul had awakened in a less than cheery frame of mind. Annie, on the other hand, had never been in better spirits than she was during that sunny early spring week. She cleaned. She cooked ambitious meals, although everything she cooked came out tasting strangely industrial, as if years of eating in hospital cafeterias had somehow corrupted any culinary talent she might once have had. Each afternoon she bundled Paul up in a huge blue blanket, jammed a green hunting cap on his head, and rolled him out onto the back porch. On those occasions he would take Mom along, but rarely read him. Being outside again was too great an experience to allow much concentration on other things. Mostly he just sat, smelling the sweet, cool air instead of the bedroom's stale indoor smell, sly with sickroom undertones, listened to the drip of the icicles, and watched the cloud shadows roll slowly and steadily across the melting field. That was somehow best of all. Annie sang in her on-pitch but queerly tuneless voice. She giggled like a child at the jokes on MASH and WKRP, laughing especially hard at the jokes which were mildly off-color, which in the case of WKRP was most of them. She filled in ends tirelessly as Paul finished chapters 9 and 10. The morning of the 15th dawned windy and dull with clouds, and Annie changed. Perhaps Paul thought it was the falling barometer. It was as good an explanation as any. She did not show up with his medication until 9 o'clock, and by then he needed it quite badly, so badly that he had been thinking of going to his stash. There was no breakfast, just the pills. When she came in, she was still in her pink quilted housecoat. He noted with deep misgivings that there were red marks like wheels on her cheeks and arms. He also saw gooey splatters of food on the housecoat, and she had only managed to get on one of her slippers. Thud slush went Annie's feet as she approached him. Thud slush, thud slush, thud slush. Her hair hung around her face. Her eyes were dull. "Here." She threw the pills at him. Her hands were also covered with mixed streaks of goo. Red stuff, brown stuff, sticky white stuff. Paul had no idea what it was. He wasn't sure he wanted to know. The pills hit his chest and bounced into his lap. She turned to go. Thud slush, thud slush, thud slush. "Annie?" She stopped, not turning around. She looked bigger that way, with her shoulders rounding the pink housecoat, her hair like some battered helmet.
She looked like a Piltdown woman staring out of her cave. Annie, are you all right?
No, she said indifferently, and turned around.
She looked at him with that same dullard's expression as she pinched her lower lip between the thumb and first finger of her right hand.